You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On today's show, Sean Brock, kind of like the preacher man of the Southern cooking revival. Brock is most famously known for his restaurants Husk and McCrady's in Charleston, South Carolina, but he also recently opened Monero, a kind of a Southern-inflected Mexican restaurant. A few weeks ago, Andrew Knowlton, our resident Southern guy here at Bon Appetit and also our deputy editor, was in Charleston for its annual Wine and Food Festival. And Brock and Knowlton sat down to talk cooking and food. And, well, if you talk to Sean, you're probably going to end up talking about bourbon and Southern rock and roll also. So, even better. Let's listen in. Andrew Knowlton, Sean Brock.
Welcome, dude.
Thanks a lot.
How you feeling?
Great, man. Right in the middle of this crazy Charleston Wine and Food Festival. It's always so hectic and such a blur.
Well, I'm sure for you, it's almost like you travel so much, and now all the chefs are coming to your backyard, so you have to play host a little bit, right?
Yeah, that's the fun part. I mean, showing this city off, it's not that hard, you know? It kind of does it for itself.
Since you arrived here, what year did you come to Charleston?
April 3rd, I believe, or April 4th will be 10 years.
10 years. What's the biggest difference, do you think, in the dining scene? Is it just the sheer number of restaurants or the quality of the restaurants?
When I got here 10 years ago, there were only a couple farmers that were selling to chefs, and it was very, very tough to gain relationships with farmers. There was such a big history of, I don't want to say factory farming, but larger scale monocropping, and I'd just come from Nashville and had amazing relationships with a bunch of incredible farmers that I have to this very day, and was a little spoiled. Out of frustration, I started growing my own stuff and out of necessity. But these days, man, it's unbelievable. And I think now we have these incredible fishermen who are introducing us to things that were never on the menus or were never available to chefs, that doesn't matter which restaurant you go to. You're going to see and taste Charleston. You're going to taste its soil, its waterways, its culture, its history. And so what's happening now is as the chefs are rediscovering these old ingredients and getting their hands on them and tasting them, we're all starting to realize how special Charleston is. And that makes us, that inspires us to look back at the cooking of the 19th century and then the 18th century, and you see a city with its own cuisine and its own recipes and its own dishes and its own voice. And so now we can actually recreate those dishes. We can do them with the right ingredients and give them the proper respect that they deserve. You know, Hoppin' John's always the story I tell. The first time I had it in Charleston, I was in culinary school, and I lived here in the 90s, and I hated it. I just didn't understand what the big deal was, this tasteless rice.
Rice and beans, right? Yeah.
And beans, you know, you can get that anywhere. But then fast forward to Glenn Roberts' revival of all these things and tasting it.
And he's the one in charge of Anson Mills.
Glenn Roberts is the founder and operator of Anson Mills and is an incredible seedsman and historian and a wealth of knowledge and has been a big inspiration for me in my career. And he's putting our pantry back together. He has put our pantry back together, and we're tasting things that haven't been tasted in hundreds of years. And that inspires the cuisine here. And it's great because when people come here to visit, they actually taste a place. And I think that's fascinating.
And some of those ingredients are like Carolina gold rice, the Sea Island peas. What are some of the other things that you've worked with him at Anson Mills to kind of get out there and explore?
Many, many years ago, I'd been at McCrady's for a couple of years, and I was invited to do a demo at Star Chefs in New York City, and I was terrified. It's a big stage, and I was in my 20s, and
this was before Sean Brock was Sean Brock, shit. Too, right?
And I brought Glenn. I asked Glenn to come to McCrady's, and I wanted to represent Charleston properly. I knew that I had an opportunity to teach the cuisine and the history, and so we went through the iconic things of all the different varieties of corn and rice and peas. And he said, but you know what the missing link is? That's Benny. And he really restored that that crop and
explain to people what béarnaise is.
So béarnaise is a form of sesame that came over, and it's really sesame in its unmodified state, what we call landrace. And in the 30s, the sesame in America was genetically engineered to produce more oil, which drastically changed its protein content, therefore its flavor. And so its béarnaise itself tastes nothing like what we think or know sesame to taste like. And it has so many other different uses. It's not just the seed. The plant's leaves are amazing. The flowers are amazing. Of course, the pressed oils are extraordinary. And the béarnaise cake flour that comes from that is just like powdered peanut butter. It's unbelievable. And that allows us to go and make brown oyster stew and all these things that, and with a very, very, very deep, deep flavor from this béarnaise. And people were trying to make those dishes for a very long time in Charleston with modern day sesame, and it just didn't work.
It just didn't taste the same. I'm a son of the South. You know that. I'm from Atlanta. And, you know, I didn't grow up with a lot of the foods that people associate with the South just because they weren't there in a lot of ways. I just didn't have access. And this Southern revival, which you've, you know, led the charge and kind of revitalizing and giving people like me a taste of things. And now that Southern food, you can get it in New York City or you can get it in Portland. Do you ever get tired of the Southern food trend or upset that sometimes it's, I don't know, used in a way as just a marketing ploy?
I think Southern food and Southern culture, it's still such an undiscovered thing for most people and for most Southerners. And anytime that conversation is being had at the table, then we're moving in the right direction. It doesn't, you know, doesn't matter where it is. If you're talking about a bowl of shrimp and grits, you're talking about a bowl of shrimp and grits. It doesn't matter if you're having it in Australia. That dialogue is what keeps this beautiful cuisine and incredibly diverse and beautiful culture alive. And storytelling and is such a huge part of Southern food that I think it's fantastic. I want everybody to cook Southern food.
Yeah. So you're of the belief that you can take Southern food out of the South.
I think you can take the concept and ideas and dishes of Southern food outside of the South, and that's totally fine. But one of the great things is the purity of those dishes in their home, because they exist in a particular area for a reason. They exist there because of the plants and animals that thrive based on that geography and climate, and also a staggering amount of cultural influences within each little micro region.
So you have McCrady's here in Charleston. You also have the first Husk in Charleston here, and then also you opened one in Nashville. But recently you've kind of branched out with Monero, which is a casual Mexican place. Where did the love affair start with Mexican food?
Well, you know, I am lucky enough to travel a great deal, and always find myself craving tacos and Mexican food and micheladas and margaritas. Those things make me very, very happy. And the more I traveled, the more spoiled I became, especially going to Mexico City. And I would come back to Charleston, and those cravings weren't being met, and we had, an available space, and we started brainstorming what we were going to do. And without hesitation, I blurted out tacos, and then I tried to make tortillas from nixtamalized corn and grinding my own corn, and sent a text message to the partner saying, "I'm not sure this is what we wanted. This is a lot more difficult than I imagine," which is fantastic because, you know, it was a very unique project for me because I learned so much and I was so far out of my comfort zone. I don't want to say I got lucky, but the timing of breaking my kneecap and not being able to work allowed me to really read every single book I could find. And wow, talk about diversity. Talk about a place with so many different micro regions with their own unique voices.
And you know, as untapped as a lot of the Southern larder was to a lot of people, I think even more so Mexican food, people have no I've been eating out professionally for almost 20 years, and I haven't even scratched the surface of Mexican food, and I don't pretend to know, you know, a tenth of it, you know?
Yeah, same here, and I'll never know, but I do know what I crave, and that's really, you know, it's interesting to chase a flavor that you crave and you know, and to start to try and cook that and realize that it's so complex and so incredibly difficult.
You know, when you do Southern food, you're a Southern boy doing it in Charleston or Nashville, so it feels natural. You're a Southern boy doing Mexican food in Atlanta, where there's a Manero, or the Manero here in Charleston. How do you kind of come to terms with, like, you know, trying to remain authentic or as true to the roots of Mexican food without somebody who's, you know, being not somebody who was born into that or, as you said, doesn't have a full understanding of it?
Well, you know, I like I said, I knew what I was craving and I knew what I wanted to eat. And we put together the restaurant for very selfish reasons so that we could have a place to eat all these things that we'd experienced in Mexico City. And so I really focused on Mexico City because, to me, that's the melting pot.
Right.
It's like New York City. It's,
yeah.
You know, each vendor is from a different region and has a different vibe. And I certainly don't know enough about the cuisine to focus on, let's say, Oaxaca.
Yeah.
So I just thought it would be fun to kind of bring that experience of walking around Mexico City into a little restaurant in Charleston. And the more I started reading about it, the more I saw similarities in Southern food, of course, rice and beans being very, very important, but really kind of the heart and soul to me is the corn. So to me, smelling a tortilla with beautiful corn right off the griddle gives me the same happiness that tearing into a chunk of cornbread straight out of the oven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just kind of intoxicating.
Did you go to California? Did you go to San Francisco and do any burrito research when you were out there?
Yeah, I did. But the California burrito is a completely different thing. And that certainly inspired the rice in ours.
Let's talk whiskey, if that's okay, for a minute.
I like that stuff.
You know, you and I, we've drank our fair share of Pappy. You have a lot more than I do. I'm on my last bottle, so if you have any extras, you can throw them at me. Again, with the whiskey thing, it was one of those things that, you know, you could get easily a few years ago, and now everybody and their brother and mother is drinking whiskey. And I blame partly you for that.
I always get blamed for it.
Why do you think, what happened? Like, what blew up that everybody, is it just a Southern romance? Why does everybody want to drink whiskey on the rocks now?
Well, I think it's certainly linked with the newfound curiosity throughout the world of Southern culture. And bourbon is probably the biggest representation of that. Once you become curious and once you put your lips on it, then you're hooked forever and you become passionate about it like I am. I mean, it really is something that belongs to the South. You know, it's ours. It's ours through and through, and it's something we're very proud of and passionate about. And now what we're seeing, if you look at the history of bourbon sales, it's quite interesting. The 80s, they call the glut era. Nobody was drinking whiskey. They're all doing cocaine and drinking vodka. And now there's not enough whiskey.
Right.
Because everyone's just crazy over it.
And you can't just age it overnight.
Man, you know, it's just like making country ham. It's beautiful because it takes patience and time. And just hate seeing these, people trying to rush it. It's unfortunate that people have to drink that stuff.
A few years ago when we were having a drink and I asked you, like, well, I can't get Pappy easily anymore. So I asked you what to get and you told me, like, one of your go-tos was Elmer T. Lee, which is a fantastic bourbon, just as an everyday.
Yeah, for sure.
And now I can't get that because
it's
hard to come by. Is there something that you're drinking right now that you like, or what's your kind of go-to, you know, when you don't want to spend $250 on a bottle of, you know, whatever?
I'm pretty darn picky. You know, I obsess over this stuff in my apartments filled with hundreds and hundreds of bottles dating all the way back to 1913.
How much do you think your collection's worth?
Oh, I'm not going to say that. Somebody's breaking my house. Let's just say you could buy a house.
You're broke, but you got a lot of whiskey.
Yeah, exactly. I'm currently obsessed with Willett.
Willett, okay.
In Bardstown. Drew Cole's Veen there is the master distilleries. He's 34 years old, and he's brilliant and more passionate about bourbon than I've ever seen. And they were intelligent enough to, many years ago, purchase lots and lots of barrels from all the various distilleries, and they've been keeping a watchful eye over them in their rick houses. And what they do is occasionally Drew will go through and grab a barrel, drill into it, taste it, make notes, and then eventually he'll find one that he's very, very happy with. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how old it is or where it came from. And then they'll release that very day. They dump it straight from the barrel. It's not chill filtered. It's not cut. It's barrel proof. I mean, it's the purest form of bourbon you could ever imagine. And now that's really what I'm becoming obsessed with, is whiskey straight from the barrel. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like 140 proof bourbon these days.
You water it down?
No, I don't.
You drink it straight?
I do, yeah. I will sometimes if I'm really trying to go through and taste the various notes and layers if I'm analyzing
right
it. But
you're a brave man. I still have to cut some of the barrel stuff is just a little strong for me. But
I don't know many people that like it like I do. And once you get used to it, it's really hard to go back, because once you start drinking 90 proof, it just doesn't have
that flavor or mm-hmm. complexity. While we're on the topic of drinking, a few weeks back, I asked you kind of what your favorite places to drink and have a good time in Nashville, where it's kind of your second home.
Yeah, for sure.
You talk about Charleston coming a long ways. I mean, the way that Nashville has come on of late with the restaurants they have there and just the entertainment and the music and all that, it's really blowing up. So we have a story in our May issue, which is coming up, had a party in Nashville. Tell me about some of your favorite places in Nashville that you like to have a good time and why.
Well, there's two scenarios. There's the getting rowdy one and there's the relaxing and having a nice cocktail one. So
I didn't know that existed in Nashville.
for getting rowdy, I think a perfect night for me is bellying up to Robert's and having a fried bologna sandwich. And
that's Robert's Western World.
Yeah,
that's right on the main drag there, right
on Broadway.
Yeah,
and just you know, drinking a large amount of Coors Golden, and then I love this bar called 308. It's called Number 308. It's a bar that has incredibly complex cocktails, but they take a minute to make rather than an hour. And so the vibe in there is very energetic and very, I mean, it's, you can really pass some time in there or lose track of time.
Speaking of hangovers, the worst hangover I've ever had in my life was after a night with you. You passed through the bar. We weren't there for too long, at a place called Santa's in Nashville. That's a dangerous, dangerous bar.
Well, I was gonna say you go to 308 and once it's time to move on, you make your way to Santa's. And it's really one of the more unique dive bars that you'll ever go into. It's basically, I mean, it's very similar to the trailer park parties that I grew up with in the Appalachian Mountains. You're basically in a trailer with a very low ceiling and lots of smoke everywhere and cheap beer.
And there's a guy who looks like Santa.
He
there,
sure
right?
does.
And what time do the bars close in Nashville?
Oh, 3, 4. I don't even know.
I know you love music, and we share, you know, a love of Widespread Panic and The Dead. But I know you're a huge Jason Isbell fan. Who people don't know, was in the Drive-By Truckers for a while. And what do you love about his music?
Well, I think Jason is the most talented singer-songwriter of our generation. Not only does he have an amazing voice and can play the hell out of guitar, mm-hmm. His songwriting is just so intelligent. And oftentimes it's stories that I can directly relate to growing up in the South. But his last two albums, I think, are just absolutely perfect. Southeastern in my opinion, is the greatest album ever written. Wow. I mean, if you can sit through that album and not get choked up, you don't have a heart. I had some friends from Joe Beef drive down from Montreal, and I was trying to give them the full Southern experience they'd never been. And on the way back from Willett, they kept hearing me talk about Jason Music, and I put on Southeastern, and it just got quiet, and someone spoke up and goes, "This is fucking sad." Like, this is really sad.
And these guys from Joe Beef are some, they're some big boys, right?
No, someone was like, "I think we should pull over and like cry and like hold each other." It's like, but you know, to write music like that, it's you know, you have to have seen a lot and lived a full life. And
he certainly has.
Yeah, and to be able to put that in a beautiful song like that is such an incredible talent. And on top of that, he's one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet and one of the kindest.
Well, on that, I want to say thank you, Chef Sean Brock, for joining us.
Thank you.
But before we go, we have one more thing that's a tradition, is our lightning round.
Oh, dear.
So just, you can give me your answer, you can give me an explanation if you want, but you got to choose one. That's the rule. So the first one is okra or lima beans?
Lima beans, hands down.
Fried chicken or shrimp and grits?
Shrimp and grits.
Oh, interesting. I would have gone with, the betting man would have taken fried chicken. Who knew? This is a tough one. This is not fair, but Charleston or Nashville?
Oh, man. I'm so lucky to live in both cities. I get to, a lot of days I get to live in both in the same day, and I'm definitely not answering that question.
It's bad for business, no matter what the answer. Since we just talked about them, margarita or a last word cocktail?
It depends on how much trouble I'm looking to get into. I like margaritas a lot, but they don't like me, so I'm going to go last word.
Okay. Tacos or burritos?
Tacos.
What kind of taco?
Pastor.
Let's see. Bertha's or Hannibal's?
Hannibal's.
Tell us about Hannibal's in Charleston.
So Hannibal's is an incredible place that is right behind the old Johnston Wales, where I went to culinary school. And it's been there since 1985. And it's the only soul food restaurant that I've ever been to with a bar that serves cold beer.
All right, because that's not kosher in a lot of places in the
South.
No,
it's it's more family oriented, a lot like barbecue restaurants. If you notice that, most barbecue restaurants don't serve beer. But when I was in culinary school, I was 19 and 20 years old, and I would sneak over there in between classes and chug Budweiser's and just shove my face with this beautiful dish they do called crab rice. And in fact, I served it a couple nights ago at the opening night party, and have a really great version of it on the menu in Nashville. And it's just like it sounds. It's a bed of rice and then crab cooked with the Trinity and a bit of bacon and lots of butter. And you let the crab get kind of crispy in the pan, and you just put that over the rice. And it's like equal parts rice and crab.
Okay.
And that's one of the most like luxurious things I think you could ever eat. And that's my current obsession.
Kumamoto's or Caper Blades?
Oh, you're trying to get me in trouble again. In all fairness, Kumamoto is my favorite oyster on the face of the planet.
And then last but not least, the one we always end on is butter or olive oil?
Butter for sure.
Butter. All right. Thank you, Sean Brock.
Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by Belle Cushing and Carrie Polis, with editing by Mitra Kaboli and additional help from Christina Che and Lily Sherman. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Greedies. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us anything about this or any episode, please email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com.